Actually, it seems a bit paradoxical, contradictory title, but as I'll try to convince you that there is some entanglement there, and actually entanglement can be something useful. And we talk a lot about entanglement, but it's a concept that is, you can say it's much easier to calculate than actually measure, but let's see if we can make something very useful about it. So this is work done in collaboration with Castelnuovo and David Chernin at Oxford. So what is a glass? Well, for one thing, a glass is a liquid-like state which doesn't seem to have any local order. Okay? It looks liquid. And the other characteristic of it is that it has super slow dynamics. Now, let me tell you what super slow is. So how slow is slow? Well, first, the glass transition temperature in a structural glass is actually defined operationally. It is the temperature at which the viscosity becomes 10 to the 13 Poise. Poise is the CGS unit for viscosity. And you can see from here, for many different materials, that when you plot Tg over T, so that everything is normalized at the transition temperature, and some systems, they just follow the straight line, which is Arrhenius behavior, you know, exponentially
activated. What is the vertical axis? I couldn't see.
Well, the vertical, this one is the log of the viscosity. So it's a log scale. So this is really doesn't, you think it doesn't belong to condensed matter, it belongs to astronomy, these scales, like, because, see, when the temperature in the fragile glasses, these guys, when it bends up like this, it's not straight, the more it's curved, the more fragile is the glass. If you change the temperature by a factor of 2, the viscosity jumps from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the 13, 16 orders of magnitude. That's quite striking. Now, the time scales, they are related to the viscosity. Most of these solids, there's a simple relation between shear stress and the time scale and the viscosity, and they seem to fit reasonably well this Vogel-Fulcher law, which is the time scales explode when the temperature gets close to the glass transition, explodes exponentially, okay? Now, showing this data, you say, okay, something's striking, but I don't know, okay, what is the viscosity of what? So let me give you some hint. Water, okay, it's 1 centipoise. Honey, okay, it's right here. Ketchup is more viscous than honey. And I think that maybe one day there will be a mathematical proof that getting ketchup out of a bottle without using a knife or hitting the bottom is probably an NP-complete problem. Okay? Now, these are very viscous fluids because, you know, the density are reasonable. But there's some fluid which is very viscous, but it's almost a perfect fluid. That's the quark-gluon plasma. And the reason is that even though the viscosity is high, the Reynolds number is very low. And this has been a topic of interest in other fields of physics. Now, there are two examples I'm going to give you. And the two examples are actually of maybe some of the most important substances that we have around, water and oil. Water is very peculiar. It's actually, even though like one would think it's something simple, that water has many, many phases. It has many crystalline phases. And it even has glassy phases. If you take water down to liquid nitrogen temperatures at very high pressure, it actually doesn't have just one phase, amorphous phase. It has two. It has a low density, shown up there, and a high density glass. So it looks like a piece of glass. Okay, this is not a crystal. It's not like an ice cube. It's a crystal. This is a piece of glassy water. And here you can actually tell the difference between a glass of water and water glass. So, another example, and this is actually, I'm quite excited because it gave me a chance to interact again with a no-time collaborator, Denise Fried, who's now at Schlumberger Research, and we found some common theme of interest, is that heavy oils. Heavy oils, heavy oils, like, for example, one good example is Canadian tar, right? But there's also heavy oils, like, which are not so heavy, difference in Saudi, what the Saudis call heavy oil is pretty much something that doesn't pour like water. But for them, it's heavy, and I'll talk a bit more about that there. But all of them, pretty much, have these structures called asphaltenes, which you can think about a little dot of graphene, for example. That's an asphaltene with the other complicated stuff on the sides, other radicals. But these things tend to pile up on the pi orbitals and form these balls, okay? Basically colloids. Now, these guys were actually here in the Schlumberger, the Canadian branch of Schlumberger research. They actually measured viscosity for many heavy oils coming from many places, Nigeria, Canada, Saudi Arabia. And they actually realized something very useful, which is if you rescale the plot, divide by the glass transition temperature, they actually fall on top of each other, which means that they have the same fragility. Now, this is very useful because even though these things at room temperature have very different viscosities depending on the well, if you know the curve, okay, if you know that it's universal, all oils, even though at room temperature they behave differently, you can find out the temperature at which it's going to start flowing. And then you can take it out of the well because these things clog the bore of the well and also the rocks. So one idea is to inject high temperature CO2, high enough temperature, you figure out from that plot what is the temperature you need. You push the oil out, and in the meantime, you're actually trapping CO2. So that's a carbon sequestration. So it's kind of it's really amazing what they're thinking of doing. And so there is the side of it. Of course, the aspect I'm interested in more is understanding the question why it collapses. But that's not what I'm going to talk about today. It's just to motivate that, unless there's something that's there all around. But let's go back to the question, what is it?
How does the depth below zero compare to KT for glasses?
It varies. It depends because you can have van der Waals many things if you go low enough temperatures. Usually it's hard to get it to go form a glass if you just have van der Waals. If you have a perfect mixture, usually you have to have like 80% of one molecule type A, 20% of B to form a glass. You need to frustrate a little bit. So, the depth just gives you basically the temperature scale. Okay, so let's go back to the question. What is a glass? So it's liquid-like, doesn't look like there's no local order, not like a crystal. And it's said to have this dynamic transition and without an apparent thermodynamic transition. And some people talk about dynamics, some people talk about kinetic transition without a thermodynamic transition. And the question I ask is, what does this mean? Okay, does this make sense? These are words, okay? You need to put meaning in it. And to me, this doesn't make sense. Okay, well, I can hear it, fine, I can live with it. But if you go deep in the question, what does this mean? So this is the question that we try to answer. And that's where this quantum mechanical, in quotes, perspective comes about. Because somehow we wanted to unify dynamics and thermodynamics. And as we show you, we're going to map the classical problem into a quantum problem and then ask the questions there, okay? So, try to look at it with new angles and using particular things, tools like entanglement, to try to address the question. So first, let me describe this mapping of classical to quantum, which is related to many things like the ones, things that Paul mentioned earlier in the question. So suppose you have configurations of a generic classical system just called C in phase space, right? For example, in spins, orientation of all spins, which ones are up, which ones are down, or position of n particles. And you have a transition matrix, which are positive probabilities of going from configuration C prime to C. This transition matrix has to satisfy probability conservation, So this is a constraint on the diagonal elements of the matrix W and the off-diagonal elements and detailed balance. Okay, if the system, if you give some dynamics that satisfies the tailed balance. And for a finite system, one can show that the matrix is finite. And it always, by construction, has a null right eigenvalue because W is not symmetric, so right and left eigenvalues are not necessarily the same. And this is the equilibrium distribution, the one that looks like this is the Boltzmann-Gibbs measure. With that distribution, the probability becomes stationary. Okay, this is a consequence of the Perron-Frobenius theorem. In a finite system, one eigenvalue is zero, all the others are negative, and I write them as minus En, where these En's are positive. And equilibration just means that when you take your initial state and you evolve, the probability is everything is going to die out with the exception of the equilibrium one. That's, you know, and the Perron-Frobenius theorem is actually what allows you to show that any finite system would reach equilibrium if the configuration space is connected, if you can go everywhere. Yeah, here it's not going to be Herschel. So that actually is the next step. Okay, so here I'm formulating the classical problem, and I have to conserve probability and detailed balance. Now, here comes the trick of symmetrizing. And this is a trick that many of us have used in connection with you know, dimer models. And the oldest reference that I could find, and by that the statement is really I had the patience to go dig up, was 1970 by Felderhoff. And I wouldn't be surprised if there were things even before then, where this was the first reference that I find that he symmetrizes the matrix with this similarity transformation, multiplying by a diagonal matrix on the left and on the right. Now, like I said, many of us worked in the problems related to the quantum dimer model, and there, that's exactly the construction one uses. Okay. Now, I rewrite this as a Hamiltonian because now it's easier to interpret this guy as I write it like this. Here, C and C prime are any two configurations. Now, two important points. If the dynamics is local, if I take, for example, in a system of spins, if I flip one spin or a cluster of spins, it means that I go from a configuration C to a C prime where I only change things locally. That means that this HCC prime, this guy multiplied by this one, is the kinetic term in the Hamiltonian that is local, okay? As long as C and C prime only differ by local moves. So the kinetic term is local. The potential term, if the energy is also a function only, if the energies, if I change a configuration from a C to a C prime, if the energy is local, okay, if this difference, EC minus EC prime, only depends on what I changed and in interactions with the neighboring spins, for example, okay, the spins, then this is a local. You can think about this as a local operation. An exponential of a local operation is local. Okay? So this is a local Hamiltonian, and it has this form of the wave function. The converse is not trivial. You can, of course, we all know, if you take a local Hamiltonian, that when you write down the wave function not necessarily can be expressed as an exponential of some classical local energy. But if you start from a classical problem with local interactions and kinetics, the quantum Hamiltonian is local. And this is where we're gonna use, what we're going to use to base many of the conclusions we have, is that, okay, there are many restrictions to local quantum Hamiltonians. And the eigenvalues of these guys are going to be the relaxation rates, the inverse times for the system to relax. And again, if the system is finite, there'll be a finite number of eigenvalues, and you just pick the smallest eigenvalue, that will tell you the relaxation rate. The ground state wave function for this Hamiltonian is just a superposition of this square root of the Boltzmann weights in the classical model. The partition function is just the overlap of the psi with psi itself. Okay, now we're going to use this quantum mechanical perspective, and since many of us actually use this to say a lot of things about quantum systems, this is a bit of payback time. Let's see if we learn something about the classical systems by looking at the thinking that there's some universal structure in local quantum Hamiltonians. Now, if I look at the spectrum, okay, as a function of a parameter. Now, the temperature in the classical system is nothing but a parameter here, okay? The temperature, it enters in the, of course, it enters here, okay? In the energy, that exponential. So it's tuning the Hamiltonian. It's just a parameter, but there's no temperature in this problem. It's a spectral problem. If I have relaxation rates, which are finite, and then all of a sudden my system gets very slow, it's because that gap has to close. But now, if I tell you, if I close my eyes, I don't know where that Hamiltonian came from. I give it to you. It's local. Yes, it has many special symmetries, but what I care is that it's local. A gap closes. How do we call it? A quantum phase transition, right? So here are just some reminders of what we discussed in the last slide. Local energy plus local dynamics, local Hamiltonian. So this is a spectral problem. And at one point, the spectrum collapses. So understanding glassiness is like understanding this collapse. Now, one thing that I should, yeah, sorry, Sharon.
Yeah, Ethan, you are like this, the collapse that only happened at one point, or a critical point, where you can't get over again, or both. So here,
protecting the gapness. Well, but there are some cases where, for example, okay, there are many types of gapness. Like, for example, in symmetry breaking, you could imagine that, for example, if you go from a discrete Z2 to say, an XY in the Heisenberg point, there you could have energy gaps. But those, for example, spin waves, but they're going to be 1 over L. So this is actually the next point I want to bring, is that what determines how slow is slow? If the gap goes as 1 over the system size, this is not glassy, okay? This is coarsening dynamics. This is, you know, and you can actually define a computational complexity of nature. You know, nature is a computer, okay? If you're talking about classical system, it's a classical computer, okay? It can handle 10 to the 23 particles much more easily than we can do molecular dynamics. But nature is not converging, okay? So the algorithm fails to converge. Now, that's because it's an exponentially hard problem for that operation, okay? So this gap vanishes exponentially in system size. Now, we know examples where the gap vanishes exponentially in system size, like, for example, topologically ordered systems. And one question could be, well, could this be a transition to some sort of topologically ordered state where you have many degenerate states? But here, I would like to say that yes, you could imagine cooking up a system that has infinitely many degenerate ground states, topological states. We have an example, and we discuss a bit about it towards the end, but we have built examples where you have an extensive degenerates. But the glass, it tends to think that it's not necessarily that, because in a topological order, if you apply a local perturbation, you cannot split the degeneracies. In a glass, it's more like an onion. You have all of these configurations. And if you apply a pinning field that fixes a certain configuration in one place, it will lift many of the degeneracies, okay? The ones that sit comfortably in that configuration. Now, you don't lift all others because there's another part of the system that has, even if you fix this guy, it can do many things. So you have to apply another one here, and you lift more, and you lift more. It's like an onion, okay? Okay, but then what else can we say if we look at the problem from a quantum perspective? Well, one can look at, for example, correlators like two-time correlators. And this is another signature. There is something funny in systems that are glassy, that the order parameter that one usually uses, it doesn't take a snapshot of the problem at a certain time. It actually needs to compare to different times. So it's a correlation in time. And you know, usually you think, okay, if you know correlation time, why don't you look at the one in space? It's, there should be some relation. Okay? Now, in this one, I won't spend too much time on this because I think that of the other ways to look at the from this quantum perspective, this is probably the least interesting. But if you write down the Edwards-Anderson order parameter and you write the evolution, you can write in terms of the eigenstates of that Hamiltonian. It's just the overlap of the ground state with the operator and n. And when you sum over all n different than zero, everything would get projected out but the ground state. But if you have exponentially small systems, even if your time is power line system size, many of them are going to survive. So you're left with this degenerate manifold, and your QEA is going to be given by that. Now, if actually this was a topological order, you would expect that a topologically ordered glass would have zero QEA because this is a local operator, and it doesn't, the states don't talk. Mm-hmm. Okay, QEA is the Edwards-Anderson order parameter for that one usually uses in, for example, the spin glass. You look at the spin at time t and the spin at time t prime, and you take in a certain order, time t to infinity, and then the difference to infinity. So the idea is that if you have some persistent of the magnet, because this guy's flipping terminally, but they have some memory, if you wish, of which way the spin was pointing. But now, it's interesting that you can actually, if you say that this order parameter, when you take tau to infinity, if it remains finite, this integral here should be blow up. But this integral is, if you do this integral from this expression, you get the susceptibility, okay, which looks like just like second order perturbation theory. So this is saying that there is a susceptibility that's blowing up. Now, this susceptibility, it's something that if you take this Hamiltonian that we constructed in that way and you add a perturbation to the to some parameter, oh, some local operator, this guy is not along that classical quantum mapping. This goes in some other direction. And actually, we say this is not a classical field in the sense that a local change in the Hamiltonian, even though this is a local change, it cannot be written as a local change in the energies. Okay, is the idea again that you can have a local Hamiltonian, but the wave function not necessarily is going to be in a given basis local. But now I'm going to turn into to something maybe I find more interesting, is to ask the following question. We've learned quite a bit in the past 15 years about phase transitions, about order that has no local order parameter, things that we didn't know, you know 15 years or 20 years ago. One of these things is the notion that you can, you know, there are transitions like the topological ones that you have to define some measure to detect this transition, which is not associated with an order parameter. And if you don't know an order parameter for the glass, that helps. One of them is the fidelity susceptibility. Okay? And if you compute the fidelity susceptibility for these types of wave functions that were built from a quantum, from a classical system, it's actually quite, there is a physical interpretation for it. The fidelity susceptibility is nothing but it's related to the derivative of the partition function. It turns out to be the heat capacity. Okay? So even if you don't have an order parameter, heat capacity is something that's really thermodynamic. It doesn't lie. So that would be the idea. If the fidelity can really capture, in general, phase transitions. Now, that's hot. Heat capacity, I'll show you.
Exactly. So in this mapping, uh-huh, the heat capacity of an ordinary classical system maps exactly to the thing.
Yeah. In the quantum system. Yeah. So if indeed there is, you know, something general about fidelity that, you know, in any local Hamiltonian, the fidelity can pick up a phase transition, in this case, it would imply that there would be a singularity in heat capacity. Now, this is an inset. Oh no. Okay, wait. This, it's a mapping. So now I'm going from classical to quantum. So I map a classical dynamics into a static quantum problem. I'm just looking at spectral. So I traded. Usually, okay, what are we doing here is like we want to answer that question. What is a dynamical transition? So how do you look into dynamics? The way to look into dynamics is like to do this mapping, because the Hamiltonian contains the information about how to evolve the system. Well, no, dynamics in which sense? Classical dynamics or quantum dynamics?
The heat capacity of the classical.
That's right.
The classical system that is in equilibrium.
That's right.
So what is the dynamic there?
What is dynamic in the? Okay, the dynamics is all in the spectrum. I'm looking at the ground state. So ground state has no information about dynamics. Yes. Yeah. So the ground state is the equilibrium. But then, here's the question. Can you separate, you know, in a local Hamiltonian, can you say that, you know, you can completely separate information about the ground state from the spectrum? For example, suppose that you had, if you look at the spectrum closes a gap, and you say, okay, we have phase transition. Do we know any phase transitions for a phase transition where the ground state wave function is a bystander and doesn't do anything? So that would be actually quite remarkable, okay, in a local Hamiltonian. Non-local, I can cook up examples for you. The P-spin model, infinite range interactions, you can have a transition which you don't pick up in any thermodynamics, but that's non-local. But in a local Hamiltonian, see, this is the puzzle, because once you think about this as a spectral problem, this would really be a phase transition where the ground state doesn't care. So that's strange. Now, this is an inset of a figure here. This is like those fragility plots of viscosity here that I don't show. But this is an inset where it shows the heat capacity compared to the solid, because you have to subtract the phonons. And indeed, there seems to be a jump. Okay. Now, how jump is a jump? Are you going to do critical scaling here? Is this like just a step? Well, these are the questions that that's the data that I can point out to. Okay, I don't think that fine scaling, just like the lambda point in helium attempted in space, has been done for glasses. But at least this says that something happens in the heat capacity. And again, heat capacity, I like to think about thermodynamics. It's the stuff that you know, it's the energy, it's partition function, free energy. Separate this from the notion of order parameter, you know, correlation function. And for exactly that reason, that's how we bring entanglement in the picture. Okay. So again, if you don't have a local order parameter, you can still hope to see something in the entanglement. For example, if you look at the topological entropy, you can pick up the topological phase transition, even though you don't have an order parameter, right? So that's one example where entanglement entropy comes in and helps. So let's just compute entanglement, the usual block entanglement of taking system A and system B. With this, usually I don't have to say much for this audience. You guys are, everybody's entangled here. But what I take here as a starting point is that if you write the state, that ground state we know for beta in terms of the equilibrium, it's related to the Boltzmann-Gibbs measure. And you write this density matrix, which interesting is not, doesn't contain just a diagonal, okay? Written this way, you actually have off-diagonal elements. And here again, I'm not talking about dynamic evolution. These off-diagonals are not gonna be erased by dynamics. No, this is what it is. It's equilibrium state, but they're writing in a way that also, you could, one way to see this is that you could extract some on top of diagonal order, off diagonal order, like for example, off diagonal long range order. Entanglement entropy is a particular case, is a more general case of off diagonal long range order. Now, for these particular types of density matrix, one can compute the entanglement entropy and relate this to free energies of system A, B, A union B, and then there's a boundary energy, where this beta F is the log of the partition function for system A, for example, FA, with Dirichlet boundary conditions. So you fix the boundary and you compute the partition function. That's what this F is, log of ZD. For the A union B, you don't have to worry about it because there's no boundary. Now, physically, it's a bit like the, well, maybe I'll show that in the next one. But maybe let me say this here. You take this density matrix, and you think, what is it when you trace B? Well, it's a bit like you average over possible effects of B on this boundary. And then A, you basically look at the what is the entropy, or what kind of configurations you have in system A, given the boundary set by B. Now, you would expect that in a glass, you know, things are not moving as it forms a solid. If you fix the boundary, you're going to affect very much what's inside there. This is, no, actually, the mutual information, no, let me say why not. If you take a mixed state density matrix, then you have to subtract the volume term. So if you take a mixed state density matrix, you can do trace A, compute SA, SB, and then you actually have to subtract SA union B to remove the volume pieces and get only an area law. But this state is actually pure. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but that one probably because that one because. But it's F, it's not S. It's F, it's not S. That's free energy. No, but the last one is here. Oh, yeah. The border will disappear. Exactly, the border will disappear. If you take the mutual, yes. This one, it does because I know in here, we actually had an example where we did compute the mutual information, and the boundary turned out to drop. Yes. Right. But it, this, so then the difference, I would say, okay, the difference is that this guy doesn't drop. Okay, but then the question, how big the difference is? Well, okay, since we got into that, we actually... This was a different work. We actually looked at the, if you can compute with the mutual information, the entropy in a classical system. And if you consider the toric code, imagine the toric code that you treat the plaquette term, say, as a hard constraint. So you send that coupling to infinity, for example. Now, you can think about this as a classical problem. Okay, you have the equal amplitude superposition of all the states there are allowed by, say, the star constraint. If you actually compute the entanglement entropy, you can compute the entanglement entropy, you can compute the topological entropy. And even the topological entropy is going to be one half of the quantum case. So the lesson here is that you cannot dismiss there is information, even if you just look at the classical system, when you do these kinds of, you know, you want to look at mutual information, there is something there that is not just, you know, it's only in quantum systems, this kind of correlation. One way to think about the entropy, at least I look at it, is like you have a set-to-set correlation. People talk sometimes about point-to-set, you know, point-to-point is correlation function, point-to-set. This is a set-to-set, right? Okay, so now let's just see what we get from it if we just reason, okay? Because right now is I'll have a model to discuss at the end. But let's take a look at, let me just reshuffle these guys by subtracting from this log of z with Dirichlet boundary conditions, z with free boundary conditions, which means just don't worry about what b fixed for a. Just let a do whatever it does in this, within the same volume. So I subtract that zf, log of zf from here to combine into these terms and push it here so that I want to write this as a log of an average of the exponential of this, basically this energy fluctuation. Now, write it this way because this is a generating function of fluctuations in the boundary energy. Now, you expand this guy, you compute the cumulants, the fluctuations of that. We know that the second cumulant, for example, is related to the heat capacity on the boundary. So we already argued that, okay, maybe the Fidelis susceptibility is already picking up singularity in the heat capacity. So that would be done. That would be the signature of a thermodynamic transition. But suppose that the fidelity does not, okay? If the fidelity does not, suppose that this guy is perfectly regular, okay, and continuous, boring. So then let's see what happens to the other piece then. So this other piece, I'm going to focus on system A and try to see what this means, log of ZAD over ZAF. Now, the counting here, I'm going to use an argument by Bouchot and Biroli when they were trying to look. It was a thought experiment that actually, if you look at it, looks very much like the ideas of entanglement. It's just that there the intuition was that, well, maybe if you fix B and you thermalize B and you see what happens in A, and you can learn something about, say, a growing correlation length at a glass transition. And they used this this argument where they were basing it all in metastable states, okay, some notion that people usually use in glass systems. But I should say that we propose that maybe looking at entanglement is unbiased. Okay, we have no assumption about metastable states, how many bases, etc. No assumption. You just look at it and see what it does. But to reason here, I'm going to follow that idea that there are metastable states and just see what happens then. So if there are n metastable states in the glass, then I can compute this guy by summing over all metastable states. And by a metastable state, I mean this idea of configurational entropy. In the glass, you could imagine you get trapped in some configuration. You still can vibrate. You still have your phonons, okay? But you have many of these. In the liquid, okay, even though the liquid, you know, things are moving around, you have only one configuration. The configurational entropy is one. Okay? You're not trapped in these many minima. But within that picture, if you sum over all these guys and free, okay, and the idea here is an assumption that once you fix B, suppose you thermalize the whole system and you take a picture and freeze B and let A keep going. There is one metastable state which likes that shape that B had, okay, and that one is happy, and all the other ones are equally unhappy, okay. It's a bit of a twist of, all unhappy guys are equal here. All unhappy guys are equal, right? So those unhappy guys, I say that there are n minus 1. And there's the happy fellow that has less energy. And this delta E is defined such a way that it's positive. So this guy has a larger weight over n. This can... If there are many of these guys, I can just divide this over by n.
Wouldn't that be all equally unhappy from the boundary, right?
Well, the argument is why they would not be.
But for example, in spin glasses, right, boundary conditions are chaotic, right? And so you change the boundary a tiny bit, and two states just diverge from each other exponentially fast.
And yeah, so, but if they're... Okay, but suppose that I thermalize, okay? That's an experiment that I don't know if you can do it really in the spin. Suppose I really
you can calculate it.
Yeah. But if I...
numerically.
Yeah, but in that case, I think that if you do, if you fix your boundary condition, the guy that was happy at the boundary, then
you change the boundary. You set back the boundary by epsilon.
No. But I fixed the boundary. Now I'm just looking at the outside, but with a fixed boundary. There was one guy which was There was one guy that fits very well, and the other ones we're assuming that doesn't. Now I'm gonna get away from the question about the spinglet because I don't want to get into anything like droplet, etc., that assume certain things about what happens at the boundary. Okay, I'm sticking to the. So I'm going to duck that question because I don't want to get into that controversy. I'm assuming exactly the same thing that, you know, it's assumed here that all configurations are equally unhappy. Then in that case, the configuration of entropy enters here. In that case, you know, if you have in a liquid, configuration entropy is order one. In a glass, if it's extensive, if you plug in here, the delta E scales with the area. If S star scales with the volume, okay? For a large enough system, if you're in a phase of S star scales with the volume, which would be the glass, versus S star going to one, it's the difference between the boundary winning or not over the configuration of entropy. So if the boundary wins, then you have E star minus delta. If the boundary doesn't, you have E star. So the idea is that the entanglement entropy would have a jump. And that jump would signal a thermodynamic transition. Two. Okay, so I just mentioned that with this argument, you also can look at the correlation length, but let me jump into. So far, it has been just trying to put order in that question. What does a dynamical transition mean? Okay, let's put some meanings in that word. But then you try to see, can you cook up a model, an exactly solvable model, then we can see at least a certain features. Hidden order, okay, and a macroscopic number of equilibrium states. So we took a variation of this model here called the Gunn-Hydrick model, which was studied in the context of random surfaces. I think they had many motivations. But the model consists of spins on the sides, four spins on the sides with plaquette interactions. Okay? So four plaquettes, and there are the verticals and the two side plaquettes. Okay? So four plaquette interactions.
Sigma is plus minus one.
Sigma is plus minus one. And in this model, there was some numerical evidence that the system was falling out of equilibrium, that it was glassy, and this was done by Johnston. What we did is that, okay, we wanted to do something exact. So we simplified the model a little. We dropped interactions on the horizontal plaquettes, planar plaquettes, but you still have a 3D model because we have interactions on the north, up this way walls. Even before we did that, you could say that you introduced theta spins, which are the products of two sigmas, just right like a gauge theory. And in that case, one can show that if you drop the horizontal plaquettes, you actually have decoupled layers of Ising planes. And then all of these guys will have a critical transition temperature of the 2D Ising model. Now you could say, okay, this is trivial, it's a planar system. Let me give another example, but this is thermodynamics, okay? The dynamics is different because I flip sigmas, not thetas. And to give put in a context, the thermodynamics of the toric coat couldn't be less boring, more boring. It's a paramagnet. It's not the thermodynamics which is interesting. It's the fact that you have non-local order, and that's because the physical degrees of freedom are not the ones that are used to diagonalize the model. Okay, same reason here that if you start flipping these sigma spins, you flip two planes, and you have correlated coarsening. And imagine what you have when you have to try to coarsen a wall perpendicular to another wall. Dynamically, it's going to be quite non-trivial. But still, this one you could say, okay, well, but you can still look at the local order by saying if you take the product of two spins, you can make it more complicated by adding j's, which are plus or minus one, but gaugeable. In that case, okay, time is running out, but I can just tell you that you throw away, there's no local order parameter, but you still have 2 to the L equilibrium states. And you're going to have a phase transition at exactly the 2 GIs in transition into a state that has many minima, which you cannot sort out by applying a field here and there. You can actually peel it slowly, but you can't peel it all. So, conclusions. We find that by looking at it from a quantum glass perspective, putting some quantum goggles here, we can give some more precise meaning to what the dynamical transition is, and make a quite strong claim that there should be a true thermodynamic transition. It's just we can't see with local order parameters, but that there should be signatures in heat capacity, in entanglement, if could be measured. That's what I say here. It can be picked up with fidelity. And there is a simple SOHO example with microscopic many minima where you can hide the order. And I'm just going to, last thing, is that what I hope here is that, you know, it's looking at the node problem from a new perspective. You know, it doesn't make the problem any easier, but it gives us new insight. And I'll leave you with some words of wisdom here.
I'm going to take this one question. Well, someone else. Yeah, you mentioned in this mapping, you suggest that in a map quantum system, the glass transition is associated with the jump. Can you mention it?
That would be within that scenario. That of metastable states. So within that scenario, there would be a jump. It's always area law.
Can,
but it's always
area. Area law
has a jump.
But this is derived.